You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Robert Bader returns to the show this week. He's the guy who gets to do all the things that I want to do. He's produced some amazing DVD sets of vintage television programs of the Marx Brothers and the Dick Cavett shows. He's produced great reissues and rare track CDs of Bing Crosby. He edited a book of writings by Groucho Marx, and he is the author of a definitive biography of the Marx Brothers' early years called Four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage, now in an updated paperback. His latest project is the completion of a trilogy of books by or about Harpo Marx. There was Harpo's own Harpo Speaks, Harpo's son's book, Son of Harpo Speaks, and now Speaking of Harpo by Harpo's wife, the late Susan Fleming Marx. Robert S. Bader, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, that's a hell of an introduction. I said, I'd like to meet this guy. Yeah, I'm very, very fortunate. I kind of get to do things that I like to see or read. So I wanted to read Susan's book, so I kind of helped her finish it.
Yeah, well, let's start with that, because there's so many things that you and I want to talk about, but Speaking of Harpo by Susan Marx, it's a great book. I enjoyed reading it so much, and it's right up there with Harpo Speaks and Son of Harpo Speaks, which are two also fantastic, great books. And how did it come about? When did she write it? She passed away quite a few years ago, right?
Yeah, she died in 2002. And interestingly, I had never met Susan when my Groucho book that you mentioned came out in 1993. I got her address from Bill, who I'd already been friendly with for several years, and I mailed her a copy of the Groucho book, not really expecting her to call me up or tell me how great it was or anything like that. I just figured maybe she'll look at it, maybe she'll read the stories that have Harpo, and maybe she'll get a kick out of it. I just felt like I should send it to her. And you know, Bill said, you know, when you're in L.A., I was living in New York at the time, because when you're in L.A., I drive down and I'll take you to lunch with Mom. And I said, boy, that would be sweet. So I happened to be in L.A. a couple of months later, and I drove down to Rancho Mirage, met up with Bill, and we went out to lunch. And Susan was just delightful. And I wasn't going to say, did you get the book I sent you? And I was just going to, you know, let it just sit there. Maybe she didn't care about it or anything. And suddenly she just said, out of nowhere, I like your Groucho book. In fact, I liked it better than I liked Groucho. I said, oh, my God, thank you. That's so great. I was like really thrilled. And we started talking. She said she liked the parts of the book that I had written. And I said, well, you know, you come in for the Groucho. I'm just kind of there as a guide. She says, no, but she liked the way I wrote. And she says, would you take a look at my memoir that I've been struggling with? And she's been unable to complete it for years. And she took a writing course in some adult education thing with Groucho's third wife, Eden, who she was very friendly with. Eden also lived down in the desert. And she had this massive manuscript that just meandered and went through everything she remembered in her life. But she wasn't all that interested in talking about her Hollywood years. And most of the book, as she had originally conceived it, was about the travels she did in her later life after Harpo was gone and her time on the Palm Springs School Board. I mean, I loved her, but that book, as she originally conceived it, was unpublishable. I mean, there would be like a 12-page passage about one school board meeting. I mean, she just remembered a lot. And I said, you know, I read it. You know, she said, would I look at it? And I was thrilled to look at it. So I took it back to New York. I printed a copy of it. I remember this funny, before computers really came in for her. Bill and I took her printed manuscript, part of it typed, part of it handwritten, had some drawings by her in it, and we took it to a copy center. We made a copy of it, and I brought it back with me. I'm reading it on the plane. It was really big, and I read the whole thing, and it was a real slog. And, you know, I called Bill. I said, what should I say to her? He goes, just be honest with her. So I called her, and I said, you know, the book, you know, is not really engrossing. It's missing a lot of the stuff that I think should be in your story. You don't talk about working in Hollywood as an actress. You don't really talk about, you know, your early years with Harpo. And she said, well, what do you plan to do about it? Wow. So that's actually how she asked me to collaborate on the book with her. Wow. It was a fun experience. And at one point I went out and spent about 10 days staying with her, and just we recorded interviews every morning. And you know, it's all written in the book. There's a little afterword in the book about my experience working with her, so I won't spoil the whole thing in case anybody wants to just read it. But she was just charming, and the stuff she didn't really care about, like I would say, can you tell me any stories about being on the set with W.C. Fields? Or did you get to meet Katharine Hepburn when you were in Break of Hearts? You know, things like that. What was Charles Boyer like? You know, those kind of questions. And she says, oh, nobody cares. That's all junk. And I said, with all due respect, it's a hell of a lot more interesting than that 12-page school board meeting. And she just laughed. We had enough of a friendship at that point where I could tell her when something was lousy and she would just give it right back to me. But ultimately, we got her talking. You know, Bill was helpful too. Got her talking about everything that was missing from her manuscript. And I started to put it together, and that's kind of where we were. I mean, we went back and forth with this for about 7 years, and she was never really ready to sign off on it because she was getting nervous about being so honest about people. She pulled no punches. She would say what she thought about Chico causing Harpo all kinds of grief. She was worried, what'll Chico's daughter think of me when I say this about her father? And then she would come to this point where she'd say, well, you know, maybe it'll come out after I'm gone. It'll be your problem. And, you know, that's kind of where it sat for many years. And then during the pandemic, I was kind of working on a bunch of projects, you know, at home. And I called up Bill because people were asking me about this book. And I said, what do you think? And the reason people were asking is because I used it as a source in Four of the Three Musketeers. I quoted something from the unpublished manuscript. And people started contacting me saying, how can I see this? When are you going to publish it? And all that. And I said, well, let me talk to Bill. And Bill said, it's a great idea. Go ahead and do what you have to do to finish it. And that's where we are. So it's out. I'm thrilled that it's out.
I am too. I'm so glad it came out. I'm a big fan of this movie that you alluded to with W.C. Fields called Million Dollar Legs, which is really a Jack Oakey movie that W.C. Fields is in. And Ben Turpin is in it. And it's a funny Paramount comedy, which is Paramount is where the Marx Brothers made their great first five films too. And Susan Fleming is the female lead in the movie.
She's wonderful in the film. She's really got, you know, she always said I was a terrible actress. I couldn't do anything. I had a terrible voice. She was very self-deprecating, but she wasn't doing it to be falsely modest or anything. She cringed at the sight of herself in a movie. And I remember when I was staying with her, I arranged with a friend of mine to borrow some 60mm prints and screen them in her place. And we watched a couple of the early films, and she didn't really want to watch it. But then once we started watching, she started laughing at herself. And she goes, oh, my God, I was ridiculous. What were they thinking in hiring me? My voice was so terrible. And I had to like lean over to her and say, Susan, did you happen to notice what you looked like? She was just absolutely beautiful, and she photographed so beautifully. I mean, she was what they were looking for at the studios at that time. Was she a great actress? No. Could she read her lines? Of course. Yeah, she did fine. She was as good as anybody else in that position, but she just wasn't motivated by it. She didn't care about it. She didn't want to be a movie star. Just didn't appeal to her. She just thought it was work. And mostly she got the job and kept the job because it was the Depression. Her father was unemployed, or they needed money. I mean, you're living with her parents. She was paying the rent. She was making a studio salary. So she did it because it was a job.
And after reading your book, I went and looked at some of her other things. There's a John Wayne movie that she's in, an early...
She's in actually two John Wayne films, but you're thinking of The Range Feud, which is the one where she's really a major part of it.
Yeah, and that's pretty good. I enjoyed it.
That's one of the ones that I screened for her. And she started to remember all sorts of things from seeing it. And she remembered telling me that John Wayne was embarrassed about being an actor because he was a football player, I think at USC. And his football buddies made fun of him and said, being an actor is like a sissy job. And he was like plagued by that. And she remembered that. She also remembered that occasionally he had a little bit of alcohol on his breath in the morning.
Huh, interesting. I mean, I never heard of him being heavily drinker, but I guess he was, huh?
No, I don't know if he was a heavy drinker, but occasionally she noticed it. But she also noticed that Fields was basically pickled all the time.
That we know, right?
But very nice. She said he was very nice to her.
Yeah, Fields was nice to her. Interesting.
But just getting her to talk about being on the set at those studios, she worked at every studio, but she kept bouncing around. She eventually told me that she got fired from Columbia mostly because She rejected the persistent advances of Harry Cohn.
The old casting couch, the original casting couch.
Yeah, you know, once I heard her stories about Harry Cohn, it made me sort of wonder, whenever I see a pretty young woman in a Columbia picture, I'd say, geez, what did she have to do to get that?
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
Excuse me. So how did Susan meet Harpo? She's quite a bit younger than Harpo.
Yeah, and her story is very, very funny about this. She had just not had her contract renewed at Columbia, and she was invited to a party by the studio, and I guess they either didn't care that she was no longer going to be working there, or they just wanted her at the party. And it turned out to be a party that was, I think, thrown by Sam Goldwyn to honor Harry Cohn, the guy who just fired her. She sat down at a table next to this man who she didn't really quite recognize. And she sat next to Harpo, and Fanny Bryce was talking to Harpo, and they were laughing, and then Susan said something, and Harpo directed his attention away from Fanny Bryce to Susan, almost as if, oh, what did she say? You know, and that was it. And she never remembered what she said that got Harpo's attention and made him laugh. But from that moment, they became inseparable. They dated for 4 years before they got married, and that's it. That's how they met.
And they adopted, how many children did they have?
Four. They had four.
It's quite a story, and I'm so glad that you made it happen. The book we're talking about is called Speaking of Harpo by Harpo Marx's late wife, Susan Fleming Marx. And Robert S. Bader, I guess you would say, is the editor of this book.
Well, yeah. I mean, the co-authors, so to speak. I guess I took the same credit on the book that Roland Barber took on Harpo Speaks, because as I talked to Susan and Bill, I sort of filled the almost identical role of what Roland did on Harpo Speaks. He pretty much recorded tons of stuff with Harpo, not tons, but enough. He made some recordings with Harpo that survived, that eventually may see the light of day. But then he would just sit while Harpo told stories and played his harp. And that's kind of what I did with Susan, but I recorded them all. Did a couple of videotapes with her too. I remember trying to get her to go on camera, and she didn't want to do it. She said, oh, come on, I have to go to the beauty parlor. I said, I'll drive you. There's a video online. We have a Speaking of Harpo website, speakingofharpo.com, where you can see this 8 or 9 minute video interview with Susan. And it's also on YouTube. But that was the second time I recorded her. We did it in 1998. We did it in 2001, about a year and a half before she passed away. And she's better in the later one. So I just used it because she was pretty shy and weird in the first one. She didn't really want to be on camera. I think we just coerced her into it. But the recordings really put together the stuff that was missing from her manuscript. And I did use in the final product a lot of her manuscript, you know, with a little bit of editorial work done to it. You know, there was typical problems of someone who had a lot to say and wasn't necessarily a writer. She wasn't a bad writer. She was a very good writer, but she didn't have a sense of what was going to be interesting to people. That's where she kind of got down on herself a little bit. She goes, oh, people don't care about this. People don't care about this. No, I care about this. She goes, well, you're a crazy Marx Brothers fan. I don't want to write a book about the Marx Brothers. I said, well, you don't have to, but your perspective on those guys would be sort of interesting to people. It'll be pretty unique.
It is really interesting because she talks about the Marx Brothers as, you know, men that she knew, one when she was married to and the other who were her brothers-in-law. And you know, we all have different relationships with our families than people who don't know our families have. One of the things that made me laugh was when she said that you just mentioned that there's recordings of Harpo for his book, Harpo Speaks. And yet, you know, I guess that's sort of the most rare thing is to hear Harpo Marx speak. And she said that toward the end of his life, he gave speeches all the time. She said the guy who never spoke, couldn't stop speaking.
he became very involved with his Jewish identity towards the end of his life. And it started in the late 40s with his great friend Ben Hecht, when he raised money for an organization called Irgun that was fighting to free Palestine from British colonial rule and eventually formed the State of Israel. And he was instrumental in building an air force for them with money he raised, along with Ben Hecht and a few other celebrities, but notably Ben Hecht. And Ben Hecht was blacklisted in England. They took his name off of movies because they weren't going to be shown, which is why Ben Hecht doesn't actually have a credit on the Marx Brothers film he worked on, Love Happy. But Harpo got really involved with Israel. When he visited it, he was transformed. And it's a really nice, charming section of the book about that trip to Israel. And Susan really, really caught that bug with him. I mean, she was obviously not Jewish, but their trip to Israel was just so interesting in getting her into Harpo's head a little bit. There's some sad stuff in the book about Susan's mom. You know, I don't want to ruin anything in the book, but Harpo was very, very enamored of his mother-in-law, and she made an anti-Semitic comment that he overheard, and it changed his whole perspective on her. He had become really devoted to Israel, and that's actually one of my favorite sections of the book. And that was something that she had written in her original manuscript, but not in the great detail she has from talking about it. So getting her to talk on tape was a way of really getting more of the story from her. And integrating that with her original written manuscript is really what my main function was. I took the best parts of her manuscript and moved some of the material that I recorded with her into that narrative. But it's all her. All the words are hers. You're right. It was very much a big editing job, but it was also a selecting what I needed from the tapes versus what I had from her manuscript. And I think it turned out well. One of the greatest compliments I had for the book came before it was published. Bill's brother and Susan's son, Jimmy, read the draft of the manuscript before it went off to the publisher. And he said, "I hear my mom's voice on every page."
Oh, that's
that's just what I wanted to hear, because it really is all about her.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Robert S. Bader. He is the co-author of Speaking of Harpo, the memoir of Susan Fleming Marx, the wife of Harpo Marx, and he is also the author of the definitive biography of the Marx Brothers called Four of the Three Musketeers.
There seems to be, so Robert Bader, I hope you'll gossip a little bit. There seems to be a little bit of resentment toward Gummo, that Gummo kind of encouraged Harpo's hypochondria to the point where Harpo went in for surgery that he might not have needed.
Well, Harpo was willing to do this because he thought it would give him the chance to go back to work. He'd had a couple of heart attacks, one serious one, and he was told to stop playing the harp and stop working. And he really devoted himself to painting. He was a really interesting painter. He loved painting. He really became involved with giving speeches for the UJA, the United Jewish Appeal, and he was content not to be working, but he was told that if he got a heart operation, he'd be able to go back to work. And that's what he really wanted to do. And he had this silly logic, and Susan laughed out loud when she told me this. He'd say to her, "Well, it's a benefit performance, so it's not really work." So he'd schlep his harp and his trunk and his props and his coat and everything, and he'd get in the car and he'd go do a benefit. And his heart doesn't know the difference that he's not getting a check for it, but he was pleading his case to Susan. And Susan, when she's telling this, is just laughing. So he was convinced that this heart surgery would make it all okay. And yeah, Gummo was the family hypochondriac. He indulged Harpo's hypochondria. And Susan was not a big fan of that. She tried to keep Gummo away from Harpo when it came to medical talk. And, you know, she's very frank about it in the book. I was concerned because I'm very friendly with Gummo's son, Bob. And, you know, he just read the book and loved the book. So I was relieved that he didn't say, "Boy, my dad got a hard time from Susan." He didn't say that. If he thought it, he didn't say it. But he did love the book. Now, her perspective on Chico is just pure exasperation, because this guy put Harpo through the ringer, and Harpo just couldn't say no to Chico. He adored him, and he just realized that Chico was never going to become a responsible person who didn't need money at all times. And Harpo ended up doing some crazy travel and some weird trips. There's a story in the book about taking a booking in Miami when Harpo wasn't really well enough to go. Neither was Chico, for that matter. But that's the story that results in yet another heart attack for Harpo. And Susan was just livid about that. When she was telling me that story, it was almost as if she was going back in time to that moment and being that pissed off about it.
Well, I think it says something interesting about Groucho, that Groucho Marx was able to have a solo career. I mean, he left when the Marx Brothers stopped performing. I know Groucho was anxious to be on the radio, and he did a lot of radio leading up to You Bet Your Life, and then including Your Bet Your Life for many years. But he made several films, Copacabana and Girl in Every, Sailor in Every Port or whatever.
That's Girl, a Girl in Every Port, yeah. Not one of his classics, by the way.
But Double Dynamite and other films. And yet Harpo was, obviously Harpo had, did not have radio as an option, but I think he wanted to make movies on his own. He tried, right?
He tried. He was very disappointed that Love Happy, which was conceived as a Harpo Marx solo project, turned into a Marx Brothers film because of the producer using the Marx Brothers to raise money to make the film. There's an extensive portion of the book devoted to that experience and what it did to Harpo and how he felt about it. And, you know, he had other opportunities. He was auditioning at some point to be in Andrew Cleese and the Lion, which would have been a speaking part. He just, you know, his heart wasn't in it. He really enjoyed doing the concert tours that he did. He did a show in 1950 called Harpo's Concert Bazaar. He just did a touring thing with a small company of people working with him, mostly about music, but a little comedy in there. And he just had a blast doing that tour. And he played nightclubs and he occasionally worked with Chico because, as people love to say this, Chico needed the money. So Harpo would go out and work with Chico. They did a very successful run at the London Palladium in 1949, and Harpo played there himself as well. He was very popular in the UK. So they all had solo careers to a certain degree. Of course, you know, Groucho's solo films, not exactly his finest work. I mean, you mentioned A Girl in Every Port. What do we really need? A couple of 62-year-old sailors? I mean, that's not a pretty weird film. Very
William Bendix, right?
Yeah, I mean, but what were they thinking? Why are they casting him as a sailor? But, you know, he was...
Just... See, now, how come Chico didn't try to, you know, get in, you know, edge himself into Groucho's pictures?
Well, you know, it's funny. Gummo was always trying to get Chico work through the other Marx Brothers. There are some interesting letters where, you know, Chico was getting booked. And Gummo got Chico booked on a tour of the UK and some other places in Europe, and he sent them down to Australia. So Chico could work on his own. He just got a much higher salary being, even if it was just two Marx Brothers, one of the Marx Brothers. So Harpo and Chico at the London Palladium, he took home more money from that than if he was playing shows himself. I mean, it was just a bigger attraction. So, you know, Gummo was advocating for Chico, convinced Harpo to take gigs that he wouldn't have normally wanted to do. You know, these were brothers looking out for each other and sometimes at each other's expense. Susan was just always concerned about what it was doing to Harpo. Chico would aggravate all the Marx Brothers. They were always running around trying to find money for him if they could. And Zeppo, I'm working on a biography of Zeppo right now, and I've been interviewing people who are close to Zeppo. And one of his friends told me that out of force of habit, Zeppo kept $5,000 in a safe in his house just because all the times they needed to bail Chico out of trouble. That was going on way after Chico was gone, that he kept the $5,000 laying around his house just in case. If Chico came back, he would almost definitely need the money.
Well, now I'm very interested in hearing about your book about Zeppo. When I talked to Bill Marx, author of Son of Harpo Speaks, and Harpo's oldest adopted child, he said that, you know, everyone knows that Chico was a gambler, but that Zeppo was a much bigger gambler than any of the Marx Brothers, and that when they went to the baseball games at the Gilmore Field, Zeppo would bet what the next pitch would be a foul or the next pitch would be a...
Yes, Susan told me that story too. And the little postscript that I'm not sure if Bill has this in his book, but Susan told me this. Harpo would get annoyed because, you know, his kids would get confused, like, you know, Jimmy and Alex and Minnie might be at the game, and why is Uncle Zeppo rooting for the team? And then he's back to rooting for the Stars. And like, Harpo would lean over and goes, "Hey, Zepp, if you can't root for the Stars, change your box. You know, go sit somewhere else." You know? He always had to have action going, but in a different way than Chico. Chico liked to beat the odds. He liked to show off as a gambler and just make ridiculous bets to see if he could pull it off. And he didn't care if he lost. Zeppo really wanted to win. He wanted to, like, beat you so bad he would take your house. You know, he wanted to win, and he was really good. He was a sharp gambler. Chico was a reckless gambler who didn't really care. Zeppo was totally motivated by taking your money.
I've also heard that Zeppo offstage was hilariously funny, which it's hard to judge from the five movies that he's in, and that he was the only one who could crack Groucho up.
Yeah, Bill has a lovely section in his book where he's at a family dinner and Groucho is laughing so uncontrollably that no one ever seen him laugh that way, because Zeppo was telling an old story about something that happened in vaudeville. And Zeppo was a funny guy. Everybody who I've spoken to who knew him will tell you that. He just felt underutilized. The Marx Brothers didn't really have room for another comedian, is the story they told. But, you know, maybe they could have. The writers could have just done a little bit more with him. But I also think that the other Marx Brothers had pretty substantial egos, and they didn't want to lose any screen time to another guy. You know, Harpo and Chico were sort of vying for that attention. Make sure the harp solo lasts as long as the piano solo, that kind of stuff. That went on behind the scenes. You don't really think about that so much.
But they're like the Beatles.
Yeah, there's a story where Betty Marx was warning Chico that Groucho's taking all the good lines. You know, if Chico ad-libbed something and it got a laugh, Groucho would be depressed that it wasn't his line. So Chico would give it to him. And then Betty would say, he's going to get you right out of the act. Pretty soon you're going to turn into Zeppo. And so Chico went and said something, and he came home and told Betty, never tell me what to do with the Marx Brothers again. He almost broke up the act. You know, Groucho needs that. Harpo needs that. I don't need it. I just want the act to be good. So, you know, Chico was sort of the link. You know, he kept the act together in a lot of ways. And then when they decided they were no longer going to do the Marx Brothers, he was the one most adversely affected by it financially because he didn't save his money.
Mm. Now, Zeppo also was an inventor, right? He invented this watch that took your pulse or something like that.
I'll say this. When the book is out, you'll get to see all this, but I'll just give you a quick little take on this. His reputation as an inventor is greatly overblown.
Oh.
He was a very creative thinker, and he did come up with some really interesting ideas, some of which you'd have no idea were his ideas because he abandoned them until somebody else came and did them. Zeppo had this idea in the 40s for something that ended up becoming roll-on deodorant, but he didn't bother with it. He abandoned it, and then somebody else made the money on it. But the thing that he's famous for as a manufacturer was this thing that's called the Marmon clamp. Marmon was his manufacturing company, and it was a clamp that was patented by someone else that came to Zeppo to manufacture it. And that has become something people think Zeppo invented. He might have modified it and tweaked it a bit, but it wasn't his invention, but it was the thing that really set his company apart and made them a fortune. And he sold that company for a lot of money in the mid-50s. But he had ideas. He wanted to do a motorized bicycle. You mentioned the heart monitor wristwatch, which that early technology ends up being what they use in something like the Apple Watch.
Sure.
You know, patents have a shelf life. They don't last forever. If you come up with an idea and you patent it and you don't do anything with it, and 20 years later, somebody else fixes it and makes it better, you don't get anything. So Zeppo had a lot of creative ideas and several patents. But he had a patent that later became the heating pad.
Huh.
He was developing a heating pad that was flexible so you could put it around your sore joints. You know, previously heating pads were like hard, flat things. You know, it's hard for us to think now about what a heating pad was like in the 40s.
Yeah.
But he came up with something that was a flexible version of that. Again, it didn't get pursued by his company. He let it go and someone else ended up doing it. But the idea of him inventing the Marmon clamp is basically not correct. He manufactured it and he made a fortune on it, but he had a contract with the guy who held the patent.
We're talking to Robert Bader, and he has written a lot about the Marx Brothers, including this fantastic book, which I think is pretty definitive, called Four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage. And now there's an updated a paperback, which you were kind enough to send me. Thank you. And I want to know what about this book. And it's a big book. I mean, it's hundreds of pages and very detailed. What did you do that's an update on it?
Well, I don't want to take all the credit for the update, because one of the things that worried me when I was about to publish the hardcover back in 2016 was what will be discovered after this book is published, because I tried to be as comprehensive as I could about their vaudeville and stage years. And I decided to put an email address in the book for readers to write in and say, oh, you've got this date wrong, or you missed this place, or they played in my city, or I went to the library in God knows where, Nebraska or whatever, and I found a date that you don't have. So I wanted people to be able to send those in to me, and I would add them to a subsequent edition. And we had a few printings in hardcover where I was able to add little things here and there. But this new paperback edition has a really comprehensive stage chronology to back. Thank you in large part to the readers who sent in things. I also continued researching it, and while researching the book on Zeppo, I discovered some other things as well. There's also the really strange thing that happened. A person I was trying to track down for years, I never was able to track down, and that would be the daughter of Mabel O'Donnell, the young girl who was in the Three Nightingales with the early Marx Brothers when Groucho and Gummo and Mabel were the Three Nightingales. And she had written an angry letter to Penthouse magazine when they published one chapter of Richard J. Noble's Marx Brothers scrapbook, which is an interview with Groucho where he says really nasty things about Mabel O'Donnell. And the daughter wrote in and a really ripping letter, like tearing Groucho apart. And she also sent a letter directly to Groucho, which I have a copy of. And I tried to find this woman, and she passed away many years ago, but I was trying to find her since the 70s. Turns out that her name was misspelled in the Penthouse magazine, and I could never find her because the name was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to find her. And interestingly enough, her granddaughter got in touch. I mean, I tracked down the granddaughter and I tried to talk to her and finally got some stories out of her. And she corrected the record on Mabel O'Donnell. It's not in the hardcover for The Three Musketeers. It's in the paperback now. But the real true story of Mabel O'Donnell comes to light through the courtesy of her granddaughter in Toms River, New Jersey, of all places. So that's a cool little thing that's added to it. And a couple other little things along the way, corrections here and there, a little additional material in there somewhere. But mostly the big difference is the stage chronology is greatly enhanced since the first printing.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're chatting this week with Robert S. Bader. He is the co-author of Speaking of Harpo, the memoir of Susan Fleming Marx, the wife of Harpo Marx. And he is also the author of the definitive biography of the Marx Brothers called Four of the Three Musketeers.
You produced a film about Muhammad Ali with Dick Cavett that was excellent. And now you have a new film with Dick Cavett about Groucho. Is that right?
Yeah, the Ali film was made in 2018. We took it to some film festivals. It's called Ali and Cavett, The Tale of the Tapes. It's basically Ali's story through the lens of the Dick Cavett Show interviews. He was on a dozen times. He became very, very close and friendly with Dick. And I started making the film while Ali was still alive, hoping I would be able to get him on camera with Cavett as some, you know, maybe a nice ending to the film. But unfortunately, he was too ill when we were getting to the point where we could shoot him. And, you know, his wife was very gracious, but he just wasn't well enough to do it. And then he passed away and I finished the film and we premiered at the South by Southwest Festival, and HBO picked up the film where you can see it now. You can go find it on HBO, HBO Max, and it's done really well. And I was inspired by the success of that film to try and do one on Dick and Groucho, and Dick just loved the idea. And that film is going to premiere on American Masters on PBS on December 27th. We just had a premiere screening of it at the Hamptons International Film Festival, which was a wonderful event. Alec Baldwin really liked the film, came out and hosted and did a Q&A with Cavett and I. And it was just a really nice film, and it's a sweet film. It's really, I describe it to people as sort of a very odd buddy picture. It's this old guy and this young guy who become very, very good friends, and there's just such a great love and affection between them. And Cavett tears up when he talks about how affectionate Groucho was towards him. And it's just such a charming film. And you said something earlier that you're glad I wrote Four of the Three Musketeers because you wanted to read it. I waited for years for someone else to write that book, hoping that I would be able to read it. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to write that book. I was just hoping some really good author would take all the research, I'd give it to him, maybe he'd write it. And nobody did. You know, I offered that research to a few people who I thought would be able to do it. You know, some people use some of it in books, but I finally just said one day, you know, if I don't do this, no one's going to, and I've got all this stuff. So I wrote Four of the Three Musketeers, and I'm really proud of it. I'm very happy it's out. And then what happened was I said, geez, I'd like to see a film about Dick and Muhammad Ali, and nobody else was going to make it. So I kind of am cornering myself by wanting to see and read these things, and nobody else does it, so I just do it myself. And amazingly, people like the stuff, so I'm thrilled, you know?
Well, I want to ask you about the Groucho Marx film. Now, I remember Groucho being on Dick Cavett, and I actually would like record it with my little cassette.
Oh, you and me both. We were living parallel lives because I did the exact same thing.
And I can remember vividly. And I know he did a show with with not only was he the sole guest a couple of times, but I know that he did a show where when Minnie's Boys was on Broadway with the cast of Minnie's Boys. And also Dick Cavett had a morning show and Groucho was on that morning show as well. Now, were you able to get all that footage?
Groucho was on the morning show with Cavett twice. Right after he first got the morning show, Groucho was one of his early guests. And then when Dick came out to California to do a week of shows in Hollywood, Groucho came on again. Those shows were erased by ABC. However, we have them in odd form. One of the guests on the second morning show was a man named Frank Buxton, whose name may be familiar to fans of shows like The Odd Couple and Mork and Mindy, very prolific television director. But in the 60s, he was a stand-up comic, and he worked clubs with Dick, and they were friends. And Frank would come on the show once in a while. And Frank had one of those early reel-to-reel video recorders that were very expensive at the time, but he had one. And he recorded that show because it aired a week after they taped it. And he only had a 60-minute tape, so he recorded it, cut the commercials out. But Frank's tape of that is the source we use in the film. And the other early morning show, they had done a best of the Dick Cavett morning show primetime special with clips from some of the shows. And there was a kinescope made of that show. I'm proud to say the film has representation of each of Groucho's appearances on the Cavett show.
I can't wait to see it. And it's going to be on PBS. Tell me the date again, December.
December 27th on American Masters.
Can't wait.
You know, hopefully many times after that. It's a fun film. And Groucho sings many of his famous songs in it. And it's really charming to see the affection between the two guys.
Well, what about Bing Crosby? What's going on with Bing? Wait a minute. He's still dead. Sadly.
He remains, yes, but he's working. He's never worked harder. The company that we use for his, HLC Properties is the company that holds all of Bing's intellectual property rights and masters and things like that. And we entered into a partnership with a wonderful company called Primary Wave. And they're now doing a lot of marketing of Bing with us. And we're really expanding his reach. There's a lot of nice things going on, like a new SiriusXM show. There's going to be some nice duets being made, but there's a lot of activity in the world of Bing Crosby. And my favorite aspect of that job is mining his very, very substantial archive. You mentioned recordings that are unfamiliar and rare. I hope to get a lot more of that stuff out. You know, when I first started working for them 15 years ago, you could make CDs. Very hard to make CDs now. You know, there's not really a market for physical product. People want digital streaming. So we'll try and do that, but we have to also take Bing Crosby's audience and kind of get them into the notion of digital streaming. Maybe we could still make some CDs, but I do want to get unreleased Bing Crosby recordings out there because there's so much wonderful material still waiting to be heard.
Well, there's a Decca recording of Bing singing It Could Happen to You. It has never been on a CD. The only version I could find on an LP was on a Reader's Digest box set that came out many years ago. There's a different version of it that's on the V-Disc CD. But the original John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, 78, of It Could Happen to You, is not on any Bing Crosby CD.
Well, first of all, it's not something I can control because we don't own the Decca Masters. We own the masters he did for his own company. But It Could Happen to You, is that from Mr. Music?
I'm not sure what movie it's from. I know originally it was recorded by, I think Joe Stafford had the first record on it.
Well, if it's from Mr. Music, you unintentionally brought us right back to Groucho, who's in that film. So just
all right, then.
No, I talk about Bing Crosby all day for you, but I haven't written any books about him.
But you are responsible for putting out some of those nice CDs. I'm glad they're out there, and I hope there's more. I like CDs, Robert.
Oh, I do too. You're preaching to the choir, my friend. I would love to see more CDs released. It's just very challenging to get them into the marketplace these days. The record companies just want to put stuff on, you know, digital streaming platforms, and they're not really interested in physical product. But you can do it if you do it, you know, in a very special way, and that's kind of what I'm looking at. Try to figure out some very, very special methods of getting product out for people who don't really do the streaming stuff. We're working on it.
There was a Blu-ray that came out recently of Too Many Kisses, which is a silent film that Harpo Marx is in. And included on there is that beautiful little piece of film that the Marx brothers made, I think, in 1954 30 of a little bit of I'll Say She Is.
Yeah, it's actually even predates I'll Say She Is. It was originally introduced in On the Balcony, also known as On the Mezzanine Floor. And it was written for them by a guy named Herman Timberg, who was a child vaudeville star. And it was filmed when they first got to Hollywood in the spring of 31, right before they made Monkey Business. And it was made for a Paramount promotional film called The House That Shadows Built. And they didn't have any footage from Monkey Business to put in there to promote it in this big Paramount anniversary film. So they did this very familiar piece of stage material that they did on stage a couple of thousand times. It was in every performance of On the Mezzanine, On the Balcony, the 20th Century Review, all of these shows. And then I'll Say She Is on Broadway and on tour. And then in a show they did later called The Schweinerei, which was a compilation of bits from their Broadway shows. They had performed that probably 2,000 or 3,000 times. And what I love about it is it's a really good record of what they were like on stage, because it's the four of them together doing a bit where each of them has something important to do. And damn it, Zeppo is funny in it.
Very.
He really is good in that. And that's just a brief glimpse of what it might have been like to see them live on stage. And I really love it for that reason. But Too Many Kisses was known to be a lost film for many years. It was discovered that it existed in the 70s, and it kind of just laid in a vault. And I was determined to get that out. And it was really important to me because Bill Marx did the score. There was no score, you know, recorded for that film. If it ever was written, we don't have it. But Bill did a beautiful score for the film. The Blu-ray is available from Film Preservation Society, which is an organization that is dedicated to finding and restoring and preserving these kinds of films. So I'm really proud to have that out there. First of all, for Marx Brothers fans, it's just a wonderful thing to have. And putting The House That Shadows Built on there in its entirety, just a great, like, nice 60-minute piece of classic vintage Hollywood stuff. It's a nice package, and the money goes towards film preservation. It's a nonprofit organization. And proud to have Too Many Kisses and The House That Shadows Built available as a double feature for the Marx Brothers fan who thinks he has everything.
I was happy to get it.
Yeah, you need that.
I also want to say that in the there's a Blu-ray set of the five Paramount films. And I thought, well, you know, I've already bought the five Paramount films and every other configuration. Why do I need this Blu-ray? And as soon as I saw Coconuts, I realized, oh, my God, this doesn't look like any previous version of Coconuts. Did you play a role in this, and why does it look so much better?
Well, I played a minor role in it. They asked me to be a consultant on it and help with it. I did two of the commentaries. I did one with Leonard Maltin on Duck Soup, and I did a commentary with Bill Marx on Monkey Business, and I wrote the booklet, and they were very, very generous. In the box set, you get a little flyer that has an ad for the Three Musketeers on it. So that was a really, really lovely thing to have happen, because it really did help sales when the book first came out. The box that you're talking about came out the same month as For the Three Musketeers. So that was pretty cool. A little synergy and publicity. People think I orchestrated that. I wish I could. I wish I knew how to do something that synergistic and great for my product. But no, I just got really lucky there. Universal was really generous with me in promoting the book that way. And there's a little documentary that was in there that I appear in, which I did under duress. I didn't really want to be in, but it turned out okay. And, you know, it's just great publicity for the book. But the films look fabulous, especially Animal Crackers, which was always cut up a little bit. Even the 1974 reissue wasn't quite perfect. Had stuff that was cut out in the 30s when the production code was censoring certain things. Stuff that we look at now as being totally innocuous, but it was missing from the film. And a film print with everything in it was found in England. And that is the new version of Animal Crackers, which you just can't beat. You won't find the uncut version of Animal Crackers anywhere else. If nothing else, buy this Blu-ray and watch Animal Crackers with everything that was missing put right back in it. It's really worth seeing. And they all just look really great. It's nice to see them that way.
Well, Robert S. Bader, thank you for everything you do. There's a brand new edition in paperback of Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on stage. And there's this marvelous new book called Speaking of Harpo by the late Susan Fleming Marx, co-written by my guest, Robert S. Bader. Thanks so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf, and won't you come back again soon?
Yes, I'll be back, I think, for my fourth go-around with you. This is fun.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.